The Honorable Judges of the United States Court of Appeals in and for the Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this Honorable Court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the Court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
Good morning, all. Please be sitting in this special venue. Our first case for argument this morning is the United States v. Peterson. Mr. Albee.
May it please the Court. Three of Mr. Peterson's convictions relate to a loan from the Greenwood State Bank. With respect to those convictions, the government relies on statements in a loan form that Mr. Peterson did not write, did not read, never knew about, and never approved. Rather, the statements in this form, Government Exhibit W7-4, were written by the bank's president, Mike Weber, and Mr. Weber testified at trial that this form was used for the bank's internal use only. In response to a leading question on direct examination, Mr. Weber assumed that he got the information that he put on this form from Mr. Peterson. But upon more pointed questioning, it was clear that Mr. Weber had no memory that would support the assumption that he made during that testimony. Mr. Weber testified that he couldn't recall when he had met with Mr. Peterson, how many times, where that had taken place, and most importantly, he couldn't recall any specific conversation that the two had ever had about the loan or anything else.
Well, where else would he have gotten the information about the purpose of the loan? He certainly didn't make it up. It had to come from the principal, which was your client.
The most logical inference that could be drawn is that the information came from Attorney Patrick Sweeney. Sweeney was the attorney for Peterson Properties of Chicago, PPOC, and in contrast to Mr. Peterson, for whom there was absolutely no documents, calendar entries, emails, or anything else showing that the two men had ever met or showing what the content of any such conversations would be, there was a specific email that confirmed that Mr. Sweeney and Mr. Weber had met. It also confirmed that they had met about the loan. Mr. Sweeney's email dated, I think, October 25th, 2007, said something along the lines of, "Good to see you yesterday, Mike. Please send me the loan package checklist. I will get you the use of proceeds statement."
Was this a new banking relationship?
This was a relatively new banking relationship. The testimony was that it was brought to the bank by Mr. Sweeney, the attorney, who was good friends with Mr. Shipley, who was another executive at the bank. And so that was another connection that Mr. Sweeney had to the bank in addition to that email that
but
showed.
He was acting on behalf of your clients.
He was acting on behalf of PPOC. There's no testimony in this record whatsoever that Mr. Peterson gave Mr. Sweeney any instructions and told him to go provide information to the bank.
He's the principal of the company.
He was the managing member. They each owned one-third of the company.
Right, so he was taking his direction from your client.
There's no testimony.
He's Sweeney, a lawyer.
There's absolutely no testimony to that effect.
Isn't that a logical inference that the jury could have drawn? We're on a deferential standard of review.
I don't believe so, because when we come to a false statement, we have to know what exactly was said and in what context. We don't know what, if anything, Sweeney, we're already speculating that it's Sweeney, but if we assume it's Sweeney, we don't know what Sweeney said. We don't know what Sweeney was told. We don't know who told it to Sweeney.
And when there was no emails or any other written record.
As I indicated, there's the one email from Sweeney saying, "Good to see you yesterday."
But not outlining what the proceeds were.
That's correct. There's no later email from Sweeney or Peterson or anybody else that said, we'd like this loan for these purposes. And one problem is when we don't have the specific words or context used, is this could have been a 20-second conversation, between who knows, I mean, again, Sweeney, Peterson, or it could have been one of the other members of PPOC, or it could have been an hour long. We don't know when Mr. Weber fills out this form and he just says simply land improvement and site improvement, whether that's just his shorthand, his understanding, his best guess, whether because this is an internal form, he figures he doesn't have to report everything that PPOC told him that the loan was for, and that all he's using this form for is to get the ball rolling, and so he's like, well, this is one of the purposes, I'll put that on. Again, nobody saw this form. Nobody had a chance to approve it. Nobody had a chance to verify it. And Mr. Weber had no recollection as to what he was told for a jury to judge whether a statement was made at all, whether it was true, false, or ambiguous.
Didn't Mr. Peterson sign the loan documents at the closing? And on those loan documents was this stated purpose of the loan, which is the fraudulent statement that forms the basis of these counts.
As the government makes clear in its response brief, the statement that forms the basis for this charge is this one in this commercial loan application. Their position is that the loan note is not a substitute for the application. It wasn't part of the application process. They think it corroborates, really what it might corroborate is some sort of knowledge. But the note itself is not part of an application. It can't serve as the basis for anything. And again,
Right, but if the purpose of the loan appears on the note which your client did sign, then it supports an inference that the jury apparently drew that he supplied the information to the bank about the purpose of the loan, and that was what was fraudulent.
But there's no good reason behind that inference, absent some information that Peterson had this conversation. I mean, when you sign a note, it's a descriptor. Again, that could be one of the purposes of the loan. There's no indication there that that's an exclusive purpose of the loan. And the specific charge that's in this indictment is that Mr. Peterson lied in making an application. And what we don't have evidence of is him making any statement to the bank, and then just as important, or more importantly, we don't know what that statement might have been so that we can judge whether his statement was true or false. It's just simply not fair to convict somebody on a false statement when it's based on perhaps the best understanding or guess of the bank president, who now, because the charge doesn't come for 7 years, has no idea what, if anything, was said that much time earlier. There's no notes. And the government could have called Mr. Sweeney as well. They did not. And if we're left to speculate about what happened, that speculation goes against the government because it's their burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt these charges.
Peterson was in charge of the finances, though, right?
He was the managing member, and there were accountants. Well, Mr. Sweeney had.
Was he in charge of the checking account also?
In charge, I don't know. He wrote checks and had authority to write checks.
He controlled those. I mean, I'm just trying to see if there is a possibility that the jury could draw an inference from the information that was supplied.
And I don't think it's right that an inference can be drawn just because he has one role that he made the statement, especially when we have the contrary evidence that Mr. Sweeney was the one that was the point of contact in providing information about the loan. And without the specifics, we can't judge whether a statement that he made, if he made one, was true or false.
Didn't these inferences all flow from the type of loan, commercial loan? Is that what you're saying? I mean, there's nothing, your point is there's nothing written or committed to writing or said that anybody remembers except for the fact that it was a, quote, commercial loan. And purpose, the argument of the gambling was not part of the commercial loan.
Well, in fact, the loan was used for this purpose and others. There were questions at trial about hard costs and soft costs and whether those are appropriately included in a loan. But one purpose was that it was used, under anybody's interpretation of the words, for land improvement. And so when this shorthand is used on a note or a closing statement, that's not inaccurate, but it's not part of the application or statement Mr. Peterson made.
I thought the evidence was that almost the entire proceeds of the loan went to pay off his debts for his other companies, as well as his gambling debts.
Mr. Peterson took a $250,000 development fee that had been previously approved in the minutes, took that $250,000, and used that as part of a $300,000 payment to a casino. In terms of the remainder of the money, about $193,000 went to pay things related to construction, I'll say, and some miscellaneous legal fees. $128,000 went for Sweeney's legal fees. $80,000 or so went to pay debt service on a loan that they had pending with Johnson Bank. $200,000 went to Dr. Michael Shapiro, who's another partner. That didn't go to Peterson. $200,000 went to Shapiro. And then $200,000 went to Maverick. And we did put in evidence at trial that Maverick was owed money for legal fees that they had paid in the past on behalf of PPOC.
Right. Well, in this list, I'm not hearing land improvements and site improvements.
Well, about $191,000. There's $155,000 that went to Mr. Spar into an excavating company and another company got $25,000 too. That was $155,000. And then there was some miscellaneous costs getting up to $191,000 that included some legal fees, but also I think some sorts of site costs. But the problem is what we don't have is the false statement by Mr. Peterson. We don't have anybody who recalls him, what statement he made, when that was, where it was, what was the nature of it, in order for a jury to be able to judge whether it was false or not. That's what's missing. That's what's missing at the end of the day. We're not. If Mr. Peterson had made the statement that this loan is only for land improvement, we wouldn't have this argument. But there's no proof. There's no proof of that. There's no proof of that at all. The second issue that we raised in terms of sufficiency of the evidence relates to the M&I Bank. And there, Mr. Peterson sent an email to Mr. Paulson, the banker, saying that he would not use Maverick funds for personal use. The question is, was that money used for business use or was it used for personal use? And relying on Mr. Paulson's own testimony, we established at trial that this was used for business use. Mr. Paulson testified that a distribution is a business purpose that a company uses its money for, shareholder distributions, that distributions are often paid from lines of credit, that there was nothing prohibiting distributions from being paid out of the line of credit in this particular case. And then we presented ample evidence that, in fact, this was a distribution, that it was booked contemporaneously at the time as a distribution.
The jury obviously rejected that theory of the case. And accepted the government's theory of the case with respect to this town, which was that the money was directly used to pay off the casino debts. In fact, because it was wired directly to the casino, it didn't bear any indicia of having been a valid distribution of profit.
And the jury reached that verdict contrary to all the evidence in the case, because the evidence was just overwhelming that this was a distribution and a contemporaneous one. The investigation in this case did not begin for a couple of years after this. I can't recall.
Well, a distribution of profit wouldn't be wired directly to a casino. And that, in and of itself, is enough to support the jury's contrary view of the evidence.
I think one thing in terms of whether this is a contemporaneous distribution is Dr. Shapiro, who is one quarter owner of Maverick, who also received a distribution, a check is written to him for $200,000 on April 5th, the same day that the money is requested from Mr. Paulson to be wired to the casino. That check is posted on April 6th. So we have proof that the company is acting to pay distributions to both shareholders on that day at the time. There is no investigation underway. There is no other reason. There is no reason to post it as a distribution. I don't think there's any prohibition on a company deciding to pay a distribution to the partner as he wants it directed. In this case, it was to the casino. I don't think that's materially different than if it had gone into his checking account. There was no contrary evidence presented that the books were doctored, that this wasn't the distribution. The only in the government's brief, they don't seem to contest at all that this was a distribution. They say, well, maybe the jury relied on Mr. Peterson's own email a year and a half later and relied on that. But that would have been irrational for a jury in the face of all the other evidence to rely on that email that the government itself called, I think at least four times during the course of trial, a lie, at one point calling it an utter and complete lie. So at the end of the day, all the proof was that this wasn't a distribution. It might not be the most straightforward way to pay a distribution, but there's not enough
proof. Didn't you try to pass it off in the email as money needed for a down payment on a real estate purchase?
That's why he had
to have it wired to the casino in Las Vegas, because that's where the real estate was.
He provided an itinerary of properties that were being looked at in Utah.
He was trying to pass it off as something else. So it was fraudulent in a number of respects.
The government chose the manner in which to charge these counts. They chose to say that the statement, "I would not use Maverick's money for personal use," was a false statement. That statement, I submit, was not false. That is a true statement. It was used for the business purpose of paying a distribution, booked at the time, and used as a distribution. How Mr. Peterson uses it after that, I don't think addresses how Maverick used that money.
What about the date of the accounting entry? Anything you drawn from that?
I apologize.
The date of the actual accounting entry dealing with
the distribution? Yeah, I think that's important that the accounting entries are made at the time. If we look at the annual report that was provided by Rick VandenHeuvel's firm that attaches all the balance sheets, if you look at the March 31st, 2006 balance sheet, there's no distribution listed. There hadn't been any paid. And if we look at the April 30th, 2006 balance sheet, it shows that $1.2 million in distributions were paid. The other important thing, I think, is that the books show that the company was highly profitable in that first quarter and making a lot of money, and so they had the funds to pay a distribution. This wasn't, and they could have segregated money that came in from Fomex, who I think during the course of a couple of weeks here, it was something close to $1.5 million. They could have segregated that, but the line of credit is supposed to make life easier for the company, not more difficult, to have to segregate and come back. So I think that they were in a position to pay a distribution.
You have 3 minutes left.
Okay. All right, I save that time for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Shelby. Mr. DeRosa?
May it please the court. What Mr. Albee's doing is actually turning the standard on its head. Because what he wants to do is to say, let's have the inferences for the defendant who lost at trial, and Mr. Albee made the same arguments at the trial. He wants those to say, those should all be worked against the government. But the standard, as this court is well aware, is that all reasonable inferences from the evidence and the evidence itself should be viewed in the light most favorable to the verdict, which in this case found him guilty. What we have on counts 4 and 8, which is the commercial loan, is uncontroverted testimony from Mr. Weber that said, I got the information that I put on the commercial loan application from Chris Peterson. That's the testimony. He does not recall speaking to anybody else. He vaguely recalls speaking to Mr. Sweeney, but he specifically said, I don't recall getting any information from him about the loan. And what we have in the testimony is, so Mr. Weber's testimony, I got all the stuff on the loan, land site improvements, from Mr. Peterson. But then we also have corroborating information, which the defense characterized in their reply brief as some sort of fallacy of a post hoc type of fallacy. It has nothing to do with the post hoc fallacy. It has to do with corroboration of evidence. What you have is you have Mr. Peterson signing a loan closing document that says, these are for land site improvements, 7-7. And he signs a note, 7-8, that says, oh, these are also for commercial land site improvements, new $1.1 million land site improvements. when you take the testimony of Mr. Weber, corroborated by the signed, two signed statements of Mr. Peterson, signed the day afterwards, that the fund was done, it's quite reasonable. It's even more than reasonable for the jury to conclude that Mr. Peterson actually made those statements to Mr. Weber, who recorded them. And to simply ask this court now to reevaluate and to speculate and to do all, to reevaluate the evidence, which is basically the exact same arguments that were made at the trial level, is just simply impermissible under the standards.
Well, Mr. Weber did also testify that he couldn't remember any specific conversations with Peterson or anybody, and that his memory of the whole transaction was a bit sketchy.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and who wouldn't be after 7 years? But one thing he did know, he got that information from Chris Peterson. He didn't all of a sudden say, gosh, you know, I'm just going to give money out. There's a company walking down the street, or there's a guy walking down the street, I'm going to give it to him. He knows who he dealt with.
Was the testimony or evidence that this was a relatively new banking relationship, and did he recall who initiated it? Whether it was the attorney Sweeney or whether it was Peterson himself or somebody else on behalf of a corporate entity?
Your Honor, I don't recall how it was initiated. I know that there was testimony on personal relationships between Mr. Peterson and various individuals in this group, knew various people at Greenwoods because they couldn't get the money from Johnson Bank. They had basically tapped that out. And somehow there was a relationship there. But regardless, in due respect, regardless of how that did get started, the question is, what did Mr. Weber testify to?
Right. My question relates to the reasonableness of the inferences that you asked the jury to draw based on Mr. Weber's incomplete memory of the transaction. If this had been a previously existing banking relationship, where they had a pattern of practice of dealing a certain way, but apparently that's not the case. This was a relatively new relationship.
That is correct.
And it's unclear who was put in touch with whom when.
Perhaps, but what we do know is Mr. Weber testified that his point of contact, on pages 7 and 8 of his testimony, his point of contact was Mr. Peterson.
Okay, and that's the language he used.
Yes.
Okay.
Chris Peterson was the point of contact. And number two was that the testimony was, who did you deal with that? Who's the point of contact at PPOC? Chris Peterson.
What did he say? Was it that clear, or did he say, I thought I got it?
No, it was that clear on pages 78 of the record on 159, pages 7 and 8. It came from Chris Peterson. And then he goes
and
he on.
Never, and that was never qualified on cross.
Well, on cross, as any good advocate does, he beats it down in terms of it. But the question is,
yeah.
But,
well, that's the
purpose of but certainly, but isn't it also the purpose for the jury to draw reasonable inferences, which they did, and then found him guilty? And so I guess it wasn't that effective. I mean, it's hard to
They could believe the cross more than they believe the director.
Absolutely. And they could also find that this mere statement, because it's hard to recreate that here in this courtroom, and certainly based on that cold record. But we do know what the jury heard. And obviously, they credited Mr. Weber's testimony about his contact with Mr. Peterson, coupled with the two documents that Mr. Peterson signed, confirming the exact same purpose of the loan. So as a result, it although important that that there is certainly evidence out there, as they said, where it's vague or Mr. Weber can't recall every part of the conversation, the most important part is, what was the jury presented with, and what did they hear? And again, that record at 159, 7 and 8 make that clear. Mr. Whisker Weber recollects speaking to no other members about it. And like I say, he only spoke to Mr. Sweeney, but he has no recollection of Mr. Sweeney providing the information. So as a result, the question becomes, who else could have he gotten it from? And the logical inference is that he he got it from Mr. Peterson. And then after getting it, he promptly spends it on things other than the improvements. And again, there's about $155,000 that go to Mr. Spahr, Landmark Construction, and his subcontractors, and about $38,000 that Mr. Albee pointed out that went to things that were related to it. So about $198,000 of the total amount went to the improvements. The vast amount, well over $700,000, went to other things, unrelated and not for the purposes of the loan. In terms of the Maverick testimony, Your Honors, what we have here, if I can just draw just a little bit of the picture here, Mr. Peterson goes to the MGM Grand in April of 2006, and while he's there, between April 4th and April 9th, he takes out markers of about $1.6 million. And the testimony was, at the end of the trip there, he lost about $494,000. So, obviously, because he's taking a distribution, he calls up the bank and says, oh, I'm taking a distribution, so please wire transfer in money so I can spend the distribution on the gambling I'm doing down here. Oh, no, he doesn't say that. And that's the whole point. The government's point is that the testimony is that he comes up with this lie about how he's going to take money from the account because he needs the bank to send the money. He needs them to send money to the account, so he has to come up with this concoction about spending Maverick money, not on gambling, which is clearly impermissible, but he wants to spend the Maverick money on alleged real estate purposes. And he not only sends the itinerary once, but he sends it two other times, twice on the second day before 4 or 5, he sends it twice. That particular piece of evidence is telling, because if his only reason was to take this alleged distribution, then it certainly would have been handled differently. And putting it into his own account, treating it as a distribution, would have been something else. And again, the idea that somehow it relates or should have been related to a distribution just doesn't hold. It's really sort of a justification, a bookkeeping justification to explain otherwise stealing the money. And if you think about it, how else was the company going to explain it? They can't say to the owner of the company, oh, by the way, you've obviously stolen the money, therefore.
Mr. Jarosz, why is the government interested in a closely held corporation having a shareholder distribution? And whatever the shareholder does with the funds, it's his or her business.
If that was the case.
How do we know that just because he has the ability to trigger the shareholder distribution, how do we know what the intent is? I mean, here it appears the evidence is we will state it that it had a particular motive. But what is the concern? Who is the government protecting here?
Well, Your Honor, in this case, the government's protecting the bank and its shareholders because they wouldn't have given out the money. Mr. Paulson specifically testified they would not have authorized the transfer, or the wire transfer, but for the fact that it was going to this Maverick Real Estate. That's what caused it. That's what he relied upon. So that really is the essence of it.
So is it the giving of a false reason as opposed to no reason? If he'd given no reason, where would we be?
If he'd given no reason, then there would be no false statement, and I don't think that we would have anything. You're right. But it's the false statement to the bank triggering the bank to act in reliance upon that false statement that then caused them to lose the money. And instead of going in for a business purpose, it went for gambling. In terms of the sentencing arguments, as the court's aware, the government has withdrawn argument 5B1 regarding the $300,000 repayment to M&I. I filed a letter with the court indicating that, to give it that the credit amount that we had found in the discovery evidence showed that the repayment amount was paid by Mr. Peterson towards the bank, and I filed a letter in that regard.
When was that letter?
That was filed on, I believe, either Thursday, I believe it was. And that...
just found out about it?
Yes, Your Honor. We had, when we were doing it, that the argument itself regarding the $300,000 repayment was made by Mr. Albee at the time of the sentencing, that it had been repaid. At that point, when we were going, we had gone back, then we went back to the discovery after Mr. Albee's reply to determine exactly whether the repayment was made by the sweep account. I think everybody, including Mr. Albee, had assumed that the money was repaid by the sweep arrangement.
Right.
And what we found is that, no, there's, in the 40,000 pages of discovery, there is some emails that indicate that Mr. Peterson was directing the repayment of that line of credit. It was not repaid by simply the sweep account arrangement.
So we're under $1 million for the...
We don't believe we're under $1 million. What we believe is that the $300,000, well, yeah, excuse me, for the loss amount.
You're correct, the loss amount. So
yes.
We're at the 14 added.
Yes, it should be two left. So although we believe that the judgment and order of conviction should be affirmed, obviously, it's just for that limited purpose of reassigning him the two level downward because of the...
That has an effect on the sentencing. Guidelines range, though.
It will have an effect on the sentencing guideline range.
So you're not conceding resentencing?
Only resentencing, only for that. There's two resentencing issues.
Right.
One dealt with the gross receipts,
right,
which we believe is a separate issue from this one. In other words, if you find the $300,000 repayment, it's still, he still derives the gross receipts of over $1 million.
Right, but the error about assessing 16 levels for the loss amounts
should be is
reversible error and needs to be, case needs to be remanded for resentencing on the basis of that concession?
On that narrow issue, right. And we would only say that the resentencing should occur only to award that two-level.
Well, right, but that requires full resentencing because it changes the guidelines range.
That's correct.
And the judge did sentence at the upper end of the previously calculated guidelines range. So it's a consequential error. It's not harmless.
That's correct. Okay. If the court doesn't have any more questions, simply... ask that the order of the conviction and judgment be confirmed rather than the withdrawal of the government name. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. Mr. Albee, you have 3 minutes.
To be clear, our issue with the Greenwoods counts is not with respect to the use of the proceeds of the loan. It's whether there was proof of a false statement that could support the conviction. And the government's evidence requires speculation as to who provided the information, what was said, and whether it was accurately recounted by Mr. Weber. In terms of the transcript, Mr. Weber's testimony, page, it's document 159, page 39, he says Mr. Sweeney may have been the point of contact. He says his memory of this period is very sketchy. At page 40, he says he can't remember any specific time he met with Peterson, can't remember any specific conversation with Peterson, doesn't have any notes or emails or correspondence from Peterson. He's unaware of those things existing. So he acknowledges that this could have come, that Sweeney may have been the point of contact on these things. Ultimately, there's inference upon inference, and the government's evidence can only rest on speculation. There just is nothing that says that Peterson provided the information and what specifically he said if they did ever have a conversation about the loan. Real quickly, I guess I'd like to address the $1 million in receipts. There is the $300,000 that was received from Maverick. So what we have to show is that he received individually less than $700,000 from the Greenwoods loan. The loan was $1.1 million, so our job is to show that $400,000+ went to other people. $193,000 went to SPAR or other construction or legal people. $128,000 went to Sweeney. $80,000 went to the Johnson Bank for debt service. And $200,000 went to Dr. Michael Shapiro. Off the top of my head, I think that's about $600,000, which would leave the total amount that arguably went to Peterson. We could contest the Maverick, but we don't need to because that leaves only $500,000 plus the $300,000 involving M&I. We'd have $800,000, and it's less than $1 million in gross receipts individually. We'd ask the court to vacate the convictions on all counts other than count 13, on which we asked for a retrial. The government chose to charge specific false statements, but was unable to meet its burden of proof at the trial in this matter. Failing that, we would ask for retrial on all counts or resentencing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rowley. Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed with the second case of the day, the United States versus Melendez.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May I please the court? I'm here today on a single issue, on a sentencing issue, in regards to whether this was, my client, Mr. Melendez, was part of the joint undertaking pursuant to 1B1.3. It is our position that the court, although found that it was a joint undertaking in regards to the case, and the judge was specific in regards to Mr. Melendez driving from Rockford to Chicago with Mr. Craig to purchase heroin, that the judge failed to talk about what the guidelines considered the other two steps in regards to 1B1.3, without actually conceding the joint undertaking. The focus of my inquiry at the actual sentencing hearing had to do specifically with the foreseeability. In this particular case, I had an opportunity to cross-examine the co-defendant, Michael Craig. Michael Craig had indicated in his statement that Mr. Melendez was part of this conspiracy. However, with the opportunity to actually examine Mr. Craig, it was evident and it was clear that my client had no idea about the operation that Mr. Craig had. Craig initiated the connections. He was the one who put the cash to my client to drive to Chicago. Mr. Craig rented the car. Mr. Craig was the one who took the heroin. Mr. Craig was the one who divided the heroin. There's some dispute, but Mr. Craig testified under oath that my client Melendez did not bring money or not usually money to Rockford, that the money was all Mr. Craig's, Mr. Melendez did not sell for Craig. Mr. Melendez did not have any idea what the operation was in regards to this issue. That the only thing that ties my client into a joint undertaking is the first part of the analysis. But Judge Coppola failed to do the rest of the analysis on this. And I'll say parenthetically.
He really didn't have to after he completely disregarded Craig's testimony as unreliable. So, and your entire argument seems to be relies on the reliability of Craig, the co-conspirator, that the judge didn't accept any of his testimony.
Although it is interesting to note, Your Honor, that when Mr. Craig was sentenced, the district court judge did indeed give him his 5K acceptance of responsibility. So in one regard, in my case, he's saying that Mr. Craig is not credible, but at his
actual case. He said he was not credible. He said he wasn't reliable. The judge did not object his testimony because he thought he was lying. So he could still give him the acceptance of responsibility credit in his own sentencing proceeding. said he was unreliable for a whole variety of reasons because he was, I think he said, all over the map and internally inconsistent. And that's a subtle but important distinction.
I guess I don't quite appreciate it, but I understand what the court's position is on that. But the idea of not discrediting Mr. Craig still doesn't understand where is the foreseeability component. Again, I would note that as of November 1st, we're going to have clarity in this particular jury instruction, and I've used that somewhat to follow my argument it'll be a three-step approach. It's not necessarily the three-step approach now, but the verbiage and the language is still there. And the third step has to do with reasonably foreseeable in connection to the criminal activity. And so even if they're driving to Chicago to purchase heroin, that doesn't mean that Mr. Melendez understands or has any idea of what is foreseeable in regards to what Mr. Craig is actually doing in regards to his position and what his operation is.
Well, he doesn't need to have complete information about Craig's operation. He only needs to know that they're pooling their funds to get the bulk rate on the cocaine, and then they're using the cocaine in their own drug trafficking.
So I would argue that the court is indicating that there's a joint undertaking, which is step number one, which is, yes, they got together, they ostensibly pooled some money, I would dispute that, but for purposes of right now, that they would pool their money and that they would drive to Chicago, that they would purchase heroin. Therefore, we have a conspiracy. Therefore, my client admitted its responsibility and pled to the conspiracy. But in regards to specifically the knowledge and foreseeability of what Mr. Craig is doing with his weight, because that's the only way that the judge is able to attribute or piggyback the entire weight that Mr. Craig is using for my client, because but for that amount, there would be, it would not be, it wouldn't be accessible to him. I believe that I have 1 minute, so maybe I'll just save it for a short rebuttal. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you, Mr. Craig. Mr. Cooper?
Hey, please, the court. Ms. Lambert is here also on one issue with respect to sentencing. The only issue in Ms. Lambert's case is whether the district court abused its discretion in imposing a sentence of 80 months in light of her serious health issues, her life expectancy of only 90 months, with a better than 1 in 3 chance that she would not survive more than 60 months, her low risk of recidivism, and the likelihood that she would successfully complete the period of probation. Frankly, our biggest fear before this court is that the court might adopt the presumption that a within-guidelines range is reasonable and not consider the underlying facts. Let me say a few words about the presumption. First, it's not only not conclusive, it's not intended to be highly deferential, and that language comes from Justice Breyer's opinion in Arena versus United States. The second point I want to make about that, and it's a corollary to the first, is that it is possible for a within-guidelines range sentence to be substantively unreasonable and to be an abuse of discretion. The government's cases in their brief even say that in order to sustain the presumption, the district court must provide a justification for the sentence which not only allows for adequate appellate review, but which promotes the perception of fair sentencing. That language seems to impose upon the district judge some sort of burden to show that the presumption ought to apply. The third point I want to make about the presumption is that there's no reason in this case for the court to presume that the district court was in a more superior position to make determinations based on the facts in this case than is this court. There were no witnesses.
Where you want to keep pushing this, the Court of Appeals do the sentencing, don't you?
No, I want to push the Court of Appeals.
Well, that's typical. That's what we see. I mean, we want
to do the sentencing. I want you to take a hard look at whether or not this sentence is justified or whether it's an abuse of discretion. The point I was making there was that there were no fact credibility issues because there were no witnesses, and the district court was not in a superior position. This court is in as good a position as the district court looking at
this. No, that misunderstands the standard of review. We defer to the district court's decisions as to the weight to give the different factors here. As I understand your argument, it's not that there was any kind of procedural error committed at sentencing. You know, the judge said plenty to justify his decision, and there wasn't any miscalculation, as in the last case. You're arguing about the weight or lack of weight that the judge gave for her medical condition, as I understand the core of your argument, and that that's why the sentence is substantively unreasonable. So you're asking to substitute our judgment as to the weight that factor deserves for the district court's judgment. And well, we don't do that on sentencing appeals.
I'm certainly asking you to substitute your judgment on the weight, but that's not the only thing I'm asking. I'm saying that this judge's determination of what weight to give to her medical condition, which was essentially no weight, was an abuse of his discretion. I mean, there is a point at which your disagreement is not only because you would have done it a little differently, but there is a point at which the undisputed evidence in the case simply does not support at all the judge's determination as to what weight to give. Judge Coppola, I have highest regard for Judge Coppola. Judge Coppola treated Ms. Lambert the same as he would have treated somebody who was perfectly vigorous and healthy. And yet, Ms. Lambert had congestive heart failure. She had this very this limited life expectancy, as well as quite a number of other medical conditions that are outlined.
Right, and the judge took note of all of that, didn't he?
He took note of it. Yes, ma'am. He took note of it, Your Honor. But did his sentence reflect what the undisputed evidence showed was a reasonable sentence and did promote the perception of fair sentence? With respect to rehabilitation, which is one of the 35, let me back up. What we're saying is that the sentence was an abuse of discretion because it clearly, on the undisputed evidence, did not satisfy the 3553A factors. I want to talk about two of those in particular. One is rehabilitation. 3553A, amongst its requirements, says that the sentence should provide the defendant with needed medical care in the most effective manner. Judge Coppola treated Ms. Lambert as if she was a healthy and vigorous defendant. He did not take into account the seriousness of her medical condition, the fact that she was in under the care of various specialists, which had postponed the sentencing hearing quite a number of times, and simply said that he thought the government Bureau of Prisons could work effectively. There was really no evidence to support that. I did point out to the judge that the Bureau of Standards for what treatment they are required to provide for inmates is what is minimally adequate, whereas she was getting optimal care amongst from the doctors and the specialists in Iraq. The second, the 3553A factor that I think Judge Coppola's sentence disregarded was incapacitation. This 56-year-old lady was not and still is not a threat to recidivate. She clearly committed a number of minor offenses as a young woman, but these were as a young woman for the most part. She had a number of retail theft misdemeanors. She had three felonies, which I would say were borderline felonies, one for disorderly conduct involving a false report to police at age 26, one for a felony for retail theft at age 31, when she was shoplifting clothing, and one for retail theft at age 41, 15 years before the sentencing hearing, for shoplifting 9 cans of Similac. Her involvement in the conspiracy, based on the statement in the plea agreement that was agreed to, shows that it arose from her caregiver role. She was the babysitter for Mr. Craig's children. She was employed by Mr. Craig, and the court found she was subservient to him. Mr. Craig asked her to do some things that she shouldn't have done. She very foolishly complied with her request, and therefore fell into doing some things that should have that helped the conspiracy. I see that I'm left with just a little bit of time, so I would.
Ms. Cooper, let me just ask you one area of inquiry. It seems to me you place great stress on her physical condition, and if I could just put aside her prior record for a second and just focus on that. Don't we have a district judge who has concluded she does not have, I think in his words, an extraordinary physical impairment, or that she is seriously infirm? I mean, I appreciate, and I don't question how you described it, but isn't that finding we have of a district judge on what is really the critical anchor of your argument?
You have that finding. He does say that. You have that finding.
So is that
based on undisputed facts that do not support that finding?
So you're saying that's almost clear error?
Yes, it seems to me.
That the evidence advanced regarding her medical condition is contrary to that conclusion.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Mr. Patterson?
May it please the court. Joseph Peterson on behalf of the United States.
Excuse me. We've got a misprint.
The district court correctly calculated the amount of heroin attributed to defendant Melendez, and in addition, the district court also imposed a substantially reasonable sentence as to defendant Lambert. Therefore, we're asking that both defense convictions and sentences be affirmed. Specifically, as to defendant Melendez, The district court found that the most reliable evidence of the joint undertaking in this case came from the defendant's own statements, including his plea agreement, where he admitted that he was part of a conspiracy with Michael Craig to distribute heroin, or to possess it with intent to distribute, and that as part of that conspiracy, the two of them pooled their money together, and they usually took about $4,000 and purchased heroin for $80 a gram for a reduced rate. So when the defendant today argues that they dispute that evidence, regarding the fact that they pulled the money together, Judge Rapala found that not based on anyone else's testimony other than the defendant's own statements, that including his admissions in his plea agreement. So we believe that the district court correctly credited or correctly attributed all of the heroin that the defendant and Michael Craig jointly purchased during their trips to Chicago every 2 to 3 days during an 8-month period, as the defendant admitted. And therefore, there was no error in the district court's calculation of the defendant's sentencing range. So unless there's any other questions regarding defendant Melendez, I will move on to defendant Lambert's arguments. And I would just agree with what Judge Sykes said regarding the standard in this case. What the defendant is asking you to do is get a second opinion regarding...
Excuse me, before you get into Ms. Lambert, back into the frequency of the trips to Chicago, was there an issue with regard to that, or was that, that's what they made in their plea agreement, that they said they went that frequently?
In the plea agreement, the defendant admitted that he went to Chicago every 2 to 3 days to purchase heroin, and there was additional testimony regarding the length of the time that they went, or the judge decided to take the most conservative estimate as to the length of time, being 8 months. It could have been as many as 10 months, as the judge stated. And then as far as the frequency of the trips, the judge calculated conservatively every 2 to 3 days, meaning every 2.5 days, which 2.5 days out of 30.
Well, anyway, that was the language that was used regularly and was by Melendez.
Right, that was the defendant's admission when he was first approached by law
purchase?
Correct. He said that they would take $4,000 to purchase heroin for $8 a gram, but then he also stated that they would buy between 25 and 40 grams of heroin. And Judge Capalla, again conservatively, found that there was 32.5 grams purchased each time they went to Chicago, even though the defense plea agreement appeared to be a larger amount.
Right, you're in his favor.
Correct.
Okay.
As to Defendant Lambert, it's not the role of this court to re-weigh all the district court sentencing evaluations and weights that the district court placed on all the different arguments and evidence that was presented. What the district court did in this case was carefully consider all of the defendant's arguments and mitigation and weighed them against the other evidence in the case. Specifically,
she did have a really minor role, didn't she?
Well, the court found and the defendant did not challenge the fact that the defendant was an average participant. I mean, in addition to admitting that she allowed heroin to be spent, proceeds to be stored at the apartment that Michael Craig paid for her to live in for no charge, she also...
So she could take care of the kids, right?
That was... Well, and also so that the heroin could be stored there and that she could distribute heroin to his lower-level members of the conspiracy distributed on his behalf.
What was the evidence of her involvement in distribution?
She admitted that she would distribute heroin from time to time to the other individuals that were involved in the conspiracy that actually sold the heroin on the street. She also admitted that she would arrange...
So she wasn't herself trafficking. She's a runner.
Correct. She also distributed the heroin to, collected proceeds and then provided them to Michael Craig after those individuals would sell the heroin. In addition, she also, as part of our investigation, she was caught speaking to one of our cooperating witnesses, directing him as to where he could go to pick up heroin that he wished to purchase, and then she contacted one of the co-defendants who distributed the heroin, and he made arrangements for them to connect with each other so they purchased it. So it wasn't just merely that she was at this house and was knowingly involved. And again, that finding was not challenged by the defendants in the district court.
Her record is long, but consists of extremely minor offenses. Was that overvalued by the judge, do you think? He kept talking about the long record.
Right. Well, the district court discussed not only the length of the record, but the fact that she continued to violate court orders when she was placed on probation.
That is really trivial stuff.
Well, one of the concerns that the district court had, though, was that she graduated from trivial matters, as you call them, although, I mean, there were serious driving offenses, felony, retail theft, forgery, but she graduated from that at the age in her 50s into being involved in a large-scale drug conspiracy, and that was one of the things that the district court relied on as part of rejecting the defense arguments and mitigation and finding that a sentence within the guideline range and 2 months above the low end of the guideline range was appropriate. And the district court, in this case, would have been justified in giving her a higher sentence even with her medical history, given the fact that she had that extensive criminal history.
What did the government recommend?
We recommended a sentence within the guideline range and did not make any specific recommendation.
And she got the low end and the bottom?
She got 2 months above the low end. She was sentenced to 80 months, and the low end of the guideline range was 78 months.
Do you challenge Mr. Cooper's assertion that evidence of her health was adequately considered by the district judge?
Yes, we do. The district court extensively discussed her expected
We have the district judge's conclusion. I'm just asking if you think that what was presented to the judge allowed him to come to that conclusion.
Well, there was other evidence in the record that the court relied on, specifically the fact that while the defendant was on pretrial release, she continued to work, taking care of another individual and that of elderly woman. In addition, the defendant had a positive test result for using cocaine while she was on pretrial release. That's another factor that the court considered regarding her health and medical history. So we believe
suggesting we should conclude that the decision to go with the low end was a recognition of this health issue as presented by the defense counsel.
If she had had no medical history of any kind, the district court likely would have sentenced her to a higher sentence within the guideline range based on her involvement in conspiracy. None of the other, the court properly considered her medical history. The court even went into the, by way of analogy, the guideline section regarding extraordinary physical impairment and discussed that at length. And those were some of the things that the court cited regarding the fact that she could continue to work.
What evidence did she present with regard to her medical condition? What type of evidence?
She presented written documentation from
no live witnesses or any.
No. And her attorney provided additional information to Judge Capallo in the sentencing to clarify some of the points that were raised. And as the defendant argues, the court credited that information, but the court just chose not to give it as much weight as the defendant wanted him to. So
there was a life expectancy, which was provided by some organization that you put in particular factors.
Right. And originally it was a higher life expectancy, but there was an issue with the doctor putting the incorrect weight on the first one. So we believe that the district court did properly weigh all of the appropriate sentencing factors, gave the appropriate weight to all the defendant's arguments and the evidence that they presented, and we would ask that the district this court affirm the sentence of the district court and find that the sentence that he wants was substantially reasonable. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Judge. All right, Mr. Judge. Mr. Judge, the timekeeper tells me you have 1 minute, but you may have two.
So I would like to just talk about this statement that is that Mr. Melendez made. This is like a statement that keeps on ticking. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. He's arrested a year before the indictment. He's a 46-year-old Hispanic man who, although speaks English, is more fluent in Spanish. He's in a small room with two FBI agents, and you have five lines of a statement that he made and he typed up, and the entire statement took less than a half an hour. This statement has followed Mr. Melendez to a grand jury where he is presented to the grand jury with this five statement document. It's presented.
What has to happen when you confess to the FBI?
I'm telling you, this statement has haunted him the entire time of this. It's gone to the grand jury, it went to his plea, and then the judge uses it completely at his sentencing. And the idea of that we're continuing in this cycle of sentencing illiterate and poor individuals when they have made a small statement, and then that just carries along with him, seems to me that there has to be some sanity at some point in time.
Well, after he had counsel, did he contest it?
I came along at sentencing, and so the plea agreement had already been negotiated.
Well,
and
I'm sure
so,
he had counsel then, and it was no.
He had counsel then.
Record
I don't know if he had counsel at the grand jury. But I think what Mr. Melendez's position was is that part of the plea agreement that was negotiated was that he always agreed or admitted that he did not purchase, you know, this amount of heroin, that a paragraph within the plea agreement did allow him to argue at sentencing that it was, I think it was 10 grams out of the 40 grams. And so I think he relayed that component of this and allow him to have the ability to argue, as I did at sentencing, and that's why we had a very lengthy sentencing hearing. I see that my time is up, so if the court has no other questions, I would ask that you, based on clear error in regards to the evidence, that you to overturn the sentencing issue and send it back to the judge for resentencing. Thank you very much.
Mr. Cooper, your time expired, but you may have an additional 2 minutes.
That's pretty generous, thank you. I just wanted to respond to the question regarding where the medical evidence came from, so we're clear on that. We had voluminous medical records from Ms. Lambert, most all of which were provided by the probation department to me, and I summarized them and asked that be included in the pre-sentence report, which it was. Along with some definitions from of medical terms that came from online research. So there's a great deal of detailed medical evidence in the research report. Seattle Heart Failure Monitor, the device that came up with the 7.5-year life expectancy, was attached to sentencing memorandum and a supplemental sentencing memorandum, because there were two of them. That is a result of simply inputting data regarding lab reports, age, weight, and so forth into this program that was devised by doctors on the West Coast, and that came up with the 7.5. So that was where the medical evidence and the life expectancy came from. Unless the court has any specific questions for me, I'm going to ask the court to reverse and remand.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Thanks to all counsel. Mr. Cooper and Judge, you were appointed by the court, and you have the additional thanks of the court for ably representing your clients in this case. Thank you. All right, the case is taken under review. To the final case, Martinez versus the United States. Ms. Pizarro.
May it please the court, my name is Amelia Pizarro, and I represent the petitioners Emmanuel Martinez and Timothy Vallejo. This case asks the court to determine the penalty for a RICO homicide conviction that has an intentional homicide as the predicate act. Is it, as the government argues, a sentence up to life imprisonment, or is it the same for every other intentional homicide, a mandatory life? Really, the question is whether a person who is convicted of a homicide in furtherance of an ongoing criminal enterprise gets a significant benefit not provided to any other defendant who's convicted of an intentional homicide. RICO was created with the specific purpose of imposing enhanced sentences on those engaging in racketeering activities. It was a new tool at the time for the government to combat organized crime. The idea was to establish severe consequences, both financial and in terms of imprisonment, for people who engage in a pattern of racketeering activity as a member of a criminal enterprise. That purpose cannot be achieved if a person who is convicted of a RICO homicide faces zero to life, when every other defendant convicted of an intentional homicide faces mandatory life. Finding that the sentence is mandatory means that Miller versus Alabama applies, and the appellants are entitled to a new sentencing hearing. When it comes to Miller, the parties are in agreement on several points. First, we agree that it applies to mandatory sentences. Second, we agree that it applies to juveniles under the age of 18 at the time the crime was committed. And here, both Martinez and Vallejo were under the age of 18. Third, we agree that it doesn't eliminate the possibility of a life sentence, but rather requires the court to consider specific factors related to age and its characteristics. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, we agree that it applies retroactively. So this all turns on what the penalty is and whether it's mandatory or not.
Well, yes and no. We don't have to accept the government's interpretation or yours that the Miller decision is retroactive. That's
certainly
a legal question for us to answer if we don't accept confession of error on that score.
Right, you don't have to take her word for it.
Right, so your predicate issue is the interpretation of the statute, but you're going to have to argue the other issue as well.
Okay. With Miller being retroactive, I think the government points out in its brief, it's sort of a question of whether it's procedural or substantive.
Right. And all of the other circuits don't statute has its procedural and therefore non-retroactive.
Well, that's true, but there's only been, I think, two circuits to address the issue.
Right, you're asking us to create a circuit split. And the case is sitting before the Supreme Court right now.
It is sitting before the Supreme Court. It's going to be argued in mid-October, and there the Solicitor General's office has been given time and argument and also has given the position that it is retroactive.
Right, I inferred that from the fact that the government is confessing the argument. They usually don't work across purposes in the Justice Department. But the issue is sitting before the Supreme Court on a matter coming from the state Supreme Court, as I understand it.
That's true.
Right. So the Justice Department will not have the last word, the Supreme Court will, and the issue is a live one as far as our level of the judiciary is concerned. So again, it's a contestable and contested issue that's going to have to be argued here. But you're right, we don't get to it until we credit your interpretation of the statute. So you led with a discussion of the statutory purpose, and usually we start with the statutory text. So maybe you want to start there.
Certainly, Your Honor. I think that the text of the statute, and I think we can agree that it's not the clearest written, the sort of parenthetical in the middle there. And we're not arguing that every time a predicate act has a potential life sentence that it transforms into a mandatory one if it's part of a RICO. But where the predicate act is intentional homicide, the minimum and the maximum are the same. And in that regard, the statute has to be read as whoever violates any provisions of Section 1962.
Well, predicate acts of homicide in this case, intentional homicide, were Wisconsin crimes. Were they not? They were not federal crimes.
That's true. And with the guideline application, the court looks to the equivalent federal crime. And whether it's state or federal, the mandatory minimum sentence is the same as life imprisonment. So the only difference is that in Wisconsin state court, there is the potential for the possibility of parole. And in federal court, there is no such possibility.
Right. The statute refers to the maximum penalty, including life imprisonment, not a mandatory life sentence.
But I think when it comes to a predicate act that carries the mandatory minimum sentence, those minimums sort of come along. And with an intentional homicide, that makes it a mandatory life sentence.
Right, but you're reading out the not more than language in the statute, if you're reading the parenthetical to stand on its own.
I think you're not reading out the not more than language. I think homicide makes it different, right? If it were a drug case that carried 10 to life, then the not more than certainly would be there. The sentence would be not more than life.
But then you're asking for instructions of the statute that applies differently in different contexts. And that's not usually how we do statutory interpretation.
I think that what I'm asking is that the life still be the ceiling, and that's the case under this, when the predicate act comes with a potential for life. But I think the idea that a person being sentenced under RICO, where a predicate act also comes with a mandatory minimum, that minimum would suddenly just disappear because it's part of an ongoing criminal enterprise, and that's the problem.
Well, the punishment for RICO is not punishment for the underlying act.
But I think
that can be separately prosecuted, right?
Certainly, but I think it incorporates it. The guidelines incorporate it. The way that you look at what is reasonable or the presumptive reasonable sentencing range is based on the guidelines, and the guidelines incorporate the underlying predicate act. So a person who commits homicide as part of an ongoing criminal enterprise will be treated differently than a person who commits an arson. And what the guidelines say is start at level 19, but if then you look to the underlying predicate act and you use whatever is higher, and with homicide, it's a level 43, and then it's not a range, it's life imprisonment. And
so, the guidelines are discretionary, this is not a guidelines case.
Sure.
It's a statutory case.
I think that's sort of the difference. When the guidelines were mandatory, this was not an issue, because you look to the specific range, and it was going to be in line with the mandatory minimum every time. But when the guidelines became advisory, as Your Honor points out, I don't think that means that suddenly the minimums drop off. And that a person who is committing criminal acts as part of an ongoing criminal enterprise suddenly faces less time than it would have if it had been charged separately.
Well, certainly does from the standpoint of the guidelines.
I'm not sure I understand.
There is no mandatory minimum guideline.
Right, but like, sure, but the
so
guideline.
We're talking about whether the statute is mandatory life.
Yes.
And for your reading to hold, we have to read out the not more than language in the statute, or at least read it as inapplicable to the parenthetical.
I guess what I'm saying is that where the minimum is life and the maximum is life, then yes, you read it out. And the reasonable interpretation is that it shall not be fined into life imprisonment. I think the government held that position, at least when it came to Mr. Martinez's case. When it filed the 5K1 motion, it specifically asked for a zero-level reduction in the guideline range, but relief from the statutory minimum.
Yeah, that was just a mistake. And we don't defer to the Justice Department on that either.
Would it be permissible to send someone to death under Section 90?
I think that it's possible for a RICO homicide to carry the death penalty, that the government has to go through some extra steps in order for that penalty to be possible. But yes, I think so.
What steps?
I think under the statute 3591, it requires notice to the defendants. There's a RICO prosecution taking place right now in Milwaukee that's a drug crime, and it had the potential for the death penalty, and the case sort of had to be paused while the government determined whether or not it was going to seek the death penalty and decided not to. So I do think that death is possible under a RICO prosecution. Okay, I was waiting for another question, Judge Sykes. I think when it comes to, thank you, Judge Sykes. Yeah. I would like to reserve my time for rebuttal. I thought you might want to do that.
So I'd encourage the court to take a look at the text again of 1963A if you don't have it in front of you. It's at pages 20 and 21 of the government's brief. I'll summarize the beginning, but in essence it says that someone who violates a RICO offense shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 20 years, and then the parenthetical kicks in, or for life if the violation is based on a racketeering activity for which the maximum penalty includes life imprisonment. And so it's clear on the face of this that when you have a racketeering activity that authorizes up to life, that is the maximum penalty of life, then the parenthetical kicks in. And so you would read it as imprisoned not more than for life if you're in that situation.
You're reading out the or.
The or needs to be there to follow the 20 years and to say, what is the following condition? The following condition is if you have this predicate activity up to a maximum, then the maximum goes up to life. I think it's critical to see here that if you were to want to read this as saying imprisoned or for life, as in mandating a life sentence, then you would be in a world in which you'd have to mandate a life sentence for every time you had a racketeering activity that authorized up to life. And so our brief discusses drug trafficking or other predicate activities like arson or armed robbery, things that are far short of an intentional murder. And so that is not an interpretation that even petitioners are willing to argue. On the first page of their reply brief, they concede that they do not read this as mandating life in those ways. As your questions I listed it as a counsel conceded. And so,
but some crimes, including homicide, are mandatory life penalties. no minimum, maximum, no range. It's just a mandatory life penalty. And I think the argument is that for those crimes, the not more than language in the statute just doesn't make any sense and should be disregarded. I mean, that's sort of how I read the defendant's argument here.
That's how I read it as well, but I see no basis for that in the text of the statute. And our ordinary rules of construction say that you have to follow the text.
Yeah, but you also say that where there's an absurdity, we avoid that as well. And so for a crime that carries a mandatory life sentence, no other possibility, no minimum, no maximum, just no range, just a point, life, that the not more than language is absurd when you're talking about a mandatory life sentence. So we have a different canon of construction.
Okay, I don't think the absurdity canon is what you would go to next. After text, what are the next things we look at? We look at legislative history. Here the legislative history is clear both in the House and the Senate materials that what Congress meant to do was to, and here are the words, quote, authorize or permit sentences up to life. Nothing suggesting that it was mandating life sentences. You would look at statutory context. There are neighboring provisions that involve intentional homicide, and they make very clear that they're mandating life or more death. That language is not comparable here.
Within the RICO?
Yes, I point you to section 1959 is a RICO murder offense. And that's critical to statutory context because 1963A applies a broad range of offenses. Again, ones that might include arson or armed robbery. And the petitioners here pled guilty not to an intentional murder count. If they did, then they would have known. They faced mandatory life. They struck a deal, and they pled guilty to a substantive RICO count in 1962, which is punished under 1963A, and clearly did not mandate life.
Gun would have charged the RICO murder?
They could have. They did not in this case. But that's the point, is that, as you know, conduct is often chargeable under any number of offenses that may well cover or carry different penalties. And so it would be completely improper to say that just because a mandatory minimum exists for this conduct somewhere else, that you would import that mandatory minimum into this offense. There's no canon of interpretation that would support that. The idea that petitioner's reading is needed to avoid an absurd result, I don't think is accurate either. And this case shows why. When you do have intentional murder, in a brutal fashion, shooting a Good Samaritan, as well as other predicate offenses that were attempted murder, then the judge can exercise its discretion and impose a life sentence. So there's no anomaly here, and the idea that there's this need to avoid an absurd result simply is not the case. I wanted to pick up on another point that Judge Sykes made, which is that the underlying racketeering activity to which the petitioners pled guilty was not any federal crime, such as the ones the petitioners have cited. Instead, it was the Wisconsin first-degree murder statute. And as she just noted in her argument, that allows a sentencing court to give life with parole. And so even under her notion that you would be incorporating the mandatory provisions of the predicate, then you would not be under Miller, because here the predicate was Wisconsin law did not mandate life without parole. It was life with parole. Now again, there's no basis to incorporate these mandatory minimums, but it just shows that her argument is not workable. In deciding this case, I'd encourage the court to look squarely at Croft versus Williams. The court decided that case just very recently, and it was very analogous. Croft versus Williams involved an Illinois statute that resulted in a life sentence. And this court denied the Miller argument because the Illinois statute clearly made the life sentence discretionary. And so therefore it did not reach the Miller issue. The court can reach that same result here in a very straightforward fashion. More than that, if you would look at the sentencing record here, it's very clear the district court understood itself to have discretion. It went through a very lengthy 3553 analysis. It addressed each petitioner's individual circumstances, not only their age, but also the effect of their age, their immaturity, their family circumstances, the fact that they'd begun using substances at a young age, fact that they got involved with Blacks and Kings at a young age, and how all these things would result in poor judgment, immaturity, and he nonetheless decided, mainly because of the brutal nature of this crime, to impose a life sentence. And so it was an individualized assessment, which is what Miller calls for, so there's no need to remand in this instance. And again, I point you to Croft versus Williams, because to the extent that in her reply brief, she's arguing that there wasn't enough of a consideration of the individualized nature, Croft versus Williams makes clear that you don't have to impose a new Miller sort of review when you have a discretionary statute. You stop once you decide that this was not a mandatory life sentence. That's the end of the inquiry. And so in Croft versus Williams, all that the sentencing court did was say that it had considered the pre-sentence report, which articulated the defendant's age. And that was sufficient. It wasn't necessary for it to then articulate lots and lots of things about the individual defendant. In comparison here, Judge Randa has a very thorough discussion of individualized circumstances, and hence there's no need for resentencing here.
So the government's position, we shouldn't address him?
That's correct. I don't think there's any need to reach that issue here. That's just how the case was decided in Croft versus Williams. I'd be happy to address questions on the Miller retroactivity issue, but again, I really don't think it's necessary. The court will be hearing argument on that on October 13th, very soon.
And you do acknowledge that your position in agreement with the defendants asks us to create a circuit split.
I think it's true that there are just two other circuits that on the merits have said that it's procedural, so that's correct. There are a number of state high courts that have gone both directions.
Right, but we concern ourselves with creating circuit splits among regional circuits, and so far it's two against your position. So we'd be going in the teeth of decisions from our sister circuits on the retroactivity of Miller.
I think that's a fair assessment of the circuits, yes. I don't think there's any need to do that. This court, you could proceed to decide on the first issue. Alternatively, if you really have heartburn about it, you could wait to see what the Supreme Court decides. I don't think that's necessary.
You usually wait for the high court, and usually without heartburn.
Why wait? You know better than they do. If there are no other questions, I would ask the court to affirm the judgment below. Judge Randa was ruling on a 2255 motion and knew his mind better than anyone else, understood that he had discretion when he imposed the life sentences. Therefore, there's no need to revisit that. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Mr. Rosaro.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 2 minutes.
Thank you. I think the problem is that this is an anomaly. The idea that a homicide is part of a RICO would be zero to life, but if charged as a 1959, that it would be mandatory life. And those are decisions made by the government, and it would lead to the same facts, the same act, for two very different results. And I think that's one of the problems. I also think that in interpreting the statute, I have to look at context, and context means looking at the other homicide statutes, which carry a minimum of life imprisonment. And finally, as to the sentencing that were held in these cases, I think that Miller requires more than just an individualized sentencing. It requires consideration of specific facts related to age and its characteristics. And here, the court, I think, didn't do much more than skim the surface. It, in terms of Mr. Martinez, it noted his dysfunctional family and his age and his family's involvement in the Latin Kings. But it did look at the specific impact that those things might have had on him, the way his family, the way that peer pressure might have influenced him or affected him. It never examined his ability to appreciate consequences and risks, his potential for rehabilitation. And Mr. Blanco's sentence was even, I guess, more surface than that. It never mentioned his age or any of the hallmark characteristics of Miller, and it never considered family or peer pressure. And so for those reasons, I'm asking this court to find that the minimum sentence here was a life imprisonment, that Miller applies, that that applies retroactively, that these defendants are entitled to a new sentencing hearing. Thank you.
Sir, Mr. Rowe, was this case ever considered in the state courts?
It was not considered in the state court. This is the, they were charged in federal court that were never charged in state court.
So there was no murder indictment ever brought in?
No, sir.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. Mr. Pizarro, you were appointed in this
yes,
case.
Sir.
And you have, again, as the other counsel, the additional thanks to the court for serving you.